This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, January 14th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. For 4 years, Donald Trump has lurched from scandal to scandal, never facing significant consequences for his actions, even after he was impeached on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. In the final days of his presidency, that is changing. Yesterday, the House voted to impeach Trump for the second time for inciting an insurrection against the government. 10 Republicans supported the move, and many others in the party, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, have expressed their disgust at the president's role in provoking the mob's storming of the Capitol on January 6th. But perhaps as significant for a presidency built on social media is big tech's sudden severing of ties with Trump. Twitter permanently suspended his personal account. Facebook suspended his accounts at least until after the inauguration. They were followed by Snapchat, Twitch, Shopify, which sells Trump merchandise, and PayPal, which participants in the rioting at the Capitol used for fundraising. Google, Apple, and Amazon all contributed to shutting down Parler, a platform favored by Trump's most rabid supporters. At the same time, AT&T, American Express, and Marriott, among other older corporations, said they would not donate to Republican members of Congress who voted against certifying Biden's victory. On Monday, during the Reuters Next conference, Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook's chief operating officer, explained the company's decision to deplatform Trump.
We have clearly established principles that say you cannot call for violence. In this moment, we took down those posts that we thought might be calling for violence or were calling for violence immediately. But in this moment, the risk to our democracy was too big that we felt we had to take the unprecedented step of what is an indefinite ban. And I'm glad we did.
Sheila Kolhatkar, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the significance of big tech and big business turning against Trump and how to think about free speech, hate speech, and disinformation after the presidential elections of 2016 and 2020. Sheila, welcome back.
It's good to be here, Dorothy.
This particular abandonment of Donald Trump and his congressional cronies has been a little bit overlooked in all the political reckonings of the past week. Why has it taken so long?
I think many business leaders, like Americans in general, were really horrified to see what happened in the Capitol on the 6th and the sacking of Congress that occurred. But you're right. This has been a problem for months. One could even argue from the moment that President Trump took office and started lying about the size of his inaugural crowd. He was clearly having issues sticking to the truth. And it's not like the harm that he has caused to our democracy or the harm he has inflicted on the economy due to his mismanagement of the pandemic, for example. None of that is new. So I'm inclined to be a little bit cynical about the why now question. I think at this point, President Trump is on his way out. The Democrats are going to control both houses of Congress. And truthfully, many big corporations already got the number one thing on their wish list, which was a giant corporate tax cut and a lot of reduction in regulation. So although I think they were genuinely disturbed by this sort of last chapter in the Trump administration, they also have a lot less to lose by doing something now.
You know, Wall Street and big tech have effectively become the fourth branch of government. They can exert pressure in a way that our dysfunctional Congress and the reactionary court system can't. And now they're presenting what could be the most significant opposition to Trumpism of all. And Democrats, of course, are cheering the move. But isn't all of it further proof of just how powerful these super rich CEOs have become? Republicans, after all, aren't the only politicians who depend heavily on these campaign contributions.
Yeah, it's absolutely an acknowledgement of a serious problem when we rely on a handful of business moguls to behave responsibly and ensure that our government can function and that we can have a peaceful election and a peaceful transfer of power. So, one could argue they're doing the right thing in terms of preventing future violence. It speaks to this larger issue of how much power this handful of companies has right now in both the political sphere and the economy. You know, in the case of the tech companies specifically, it's worth noting that they are under significant pressure right now. There are, major antitrust investigations, both federal investigations and investigations in every single state against Facebook and Google and other tech giants. They are facing a new administration that may prove more willing to take strong action against, some of these monopolies that they've managed to establish. So you see a lot of moves on the part of Facebook and Google in particular to try and sort of preempt some of the regulatory changes or some of the antitrust, litigation that they see coming. So they're trying to behave responsibly in some cases by showing that they can continue regulating themselves. And they're just hoping that we will cheer them on for what they're doing and let them continue deciding whether or not they have enough power in our economy.
So they're in a bit of a panic about their business interests, and Trump must be in an absolute tailspin about his own. And it's always been impossible to disentangle his presidency from his own personal business interests. He ran the White House as a way to shore up his bottom line. And now Deutsche Bank, to which he owes more than $300 million, has declared that their days of lending him money are over. New York City has canceled all contracts with the Trump Organization. And then in what must be a particularly personal slap, the PGA canceled plans to host the 2020 PGA Championship at Trump's golf club in New Jersey. And as you mentioned, he faces a range of civil and criminal legal actions related to his family businesses.
One of the most troubling aspects of his presidency, to put it mildly, was the way he was able to both retain ownership over his company, to have this sort of fake separation between himself and his sons running the company. And then the way he quite flagrantly used his position as president to bolster his company, the way he was driving federal employees, Secret Service, branches of the military to stay in his hotels and pay these exorbitant fees and to go to his golf courses. I mean, it was really shocking the way he was forcing people to fly to Mar-a-Lago to meet with him. And for a while, you could imagine a future where the Trump Organization and his business interests around the world would, they would attract a certain type of clientele. People who were fans of Trump's would still continue to spend money there. But of course, his many detractors and critics would stay away. Now we've finally reached, again, this sort of tipping point where I don't know if any organization can, really in the future plan an event at a Trump property without feeling like they are endorsing what has gone on. So I think this is finally a moment of existential threat to his business. It is somewhat long overdue, but it's going to be tricky for him to get out of this, because so much of what he does in the business sphere is based on branding. And his brand has, finally really become toxic.
And so many of his business seem to be foundering, before all of this, the golf venture in Scotland and his chains of hotels.
Well, he's in many respects, he's not a great businessman. He had been in the past a good brander and marketer, but we've seen he's not a great steward of assets and manager of money. So, yes, he was having problems. And of course, he politicized his company so badly. And now, given what's happened and the way he's still behaving, I mean, there was maybe a small window for him to sort of do the right thing and make a graceful exit and condemn all this violence, but he's still refusing to do it. So I think it's safe to say that he has completely stopped thinking about his longer term business interests in terms of his behavior. Now, that was not true before, but he seems to have finally abandoned that as a priority.
And his bluster is just endlessly confusing. Let's just take this example. He has feuded for 4 years with Jeff Bezos of Amazon and other CEOs, complaining that there's a liberal bias among big tech companies. Yet Twitter and Facebook in particular facilitated his rise to power and his omnipresence in the press and in the minds of his supporters. Could you talk a little bit about how they stoked and funded the Trump movement?
Well, there's no denying the fact that without those major tech platforms, Trump and his movement, the Trumpist movement, would never have reached the level of prominence that it has or reached it so quickly. It allowed him to sort of build up this following very, very fast. And although, you know, conservatives like to complain about liberal bias, the fact is that they have mastered the use of that technology to spread their message, to recruit people. They, you know, conservative content and Trump content in particular dominates many of those platforms. We've seen now over the last months, as people have started tracking the best performing content on Facebook, most of it is Trump related content, you know, posts, speeches he gives, columnists who like him writing about him. So there's no separating the reach of that technology from his success. And because he did seem to sort of naturally take to using Twitter in a way that no previous president has, it really helped him. And it's hard to imagine he would have been able to do this if he had been reliant on, you know, mailing pamphlets to people at home and the big three TV networks.
Not to mention the mobilizing of all of these rioters from across the country.
Yeah. And I would say the fact that his sort of Trump-friendly content did so well, because it is very controversial, because it would rile people up, it would generate conflict. You know, it did allow a lot of people to intervene, spread propaganda, most of which helped him and his followers.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Conservatives who object to content moderation and deplatforming like to talk high-mindedly about the First Amendment. That's what Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri has been doing since Simon & Schuster canceled his book contract, a book about the tyranny of big tech, by the way. Hawley has become famous in recent weeks for his very aggressive challenge of the presidential election results. Is there any merit to this argument about the right to free speech?
The First Amendment protects free speech from government censorship. It does not apply to private companies choosing which customers they work with or what content they publish. You know, what I think that was very clever about what some of these critics have done is they have used this free speech argument, which is a very good campaign tool. It's a good sort of propagandistic line to actually point out a different sort of problem, which is, I would argue, actually an antitrust problem. You know, the fact that this small handful of tech platforms, basically Google, Facebook, and Twitter, have become so dominant that their business decisions can sort of affect whether a movement can find an audience, whether a president can speak to his most ardent fans or not, is a sign of a problem in terms of the concentration in our economy. And that is a big part of why the government is pursuing these antitrust cases against these companies. In the meantime, we will have conservatives complaining about free speech when what they're really complaining about is a concentration of power among a small number of companies.
So in addition to all of this potential antitrust activity, big tech has come under really intense scrutiny before Congress in recent years for facilitating Russian interference in the 2016 election and its approach to content moderation. The public is concerned about invasion of privacy and other issues. Are social media companies facing a new administration hoping to avoid the threat of government regulation?
Yes, if you are paying close attention, you can absolutely see them quite pathetically at times doing things to try and ward off regulation. And, you know, there are these antitrust cases. There are federal cases against both Google and Facebook right now. There are state cases against those companies. There are other lawsuits in the works, so they're very anxious about that. And then you also have this other regulatory questions, Section 230, which was previously this sort of ignored, rarely talked about provision from the Communications Decency Act in 1996, which protects tech platforms from illegal content that may be posted or published on their platforms. So that Section 230 says that users are responsible for content they post or publish. The platforms themselves are not responsible. The idea then in 1996 was to foster innovation on the internet. But what we have now is a just complete impunity on the part of these companies to host all sorts of egregious propaganda, fake news, you know, interference from foreign malevolent governments. And then now, you know, violent activity. We've seen, you know, racist violence in other parts of the world that was triggered by Facebook stories. So it has become a huge problem. And of course, it's a complicated issue. You don't want to go too far and silence these platforms completely, but they are very concerned because, you know, a repeal of Section 230 would really change their ability to make money this way, which so far has been given them a complete free rein to let anything happen, almost anything, and has really only left us with public shame as a device to sort of force them to control what goes on their platforms.
And that raises the question about users. So for all of the worries, people still use Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. They can't live without Google. During the pandemic, as we've seen, they've relied more than ever on Amazon and these other platforms. Tech stocks soared in 2020. So is there any chance that any of this is going to change?
Well, I think there's a lot of momentum behind the idea of tackling some of these issues, the Section 230 issue, but also this concentration of power issue. And not to be boring and say that everything comes back to antitrust, but in a way it does, because when there are no competitors out there, really viable competitors to these companies, there's no pressure on them to behave well. If you look at Facebook's acquisition of WhatsApp, the messaging platform, people were using WhatsApp because it had really strong privacy protections. So Facebook bought them because they didn't want to compete with them. Their own messaging app wasn't doing well. And so that's all gone. And now they have no reason to offer those things. So, you know, Democrats had long been seen as more friendly to big tech companies. And this was really true during the Obama administration. You know, Google was very close to his administration. However, I think the winds have changed. And you've seen prominent Democrats like Elizabeth Warren really pushing for more aggressive action. And some of the folks the Biden administration have named to run big regulatory agencies, such as the new head of the SEC, Gary Gensler, they are much more critical, both of Wall Street and of big tech companies. So I think you are going to see a continuation of this push to kind of rein them in.
What other sort of indications have you gotten about whether Biden will deviate, you know, significantly from that, given this horror we're living through now?
Well, I think that after what happened in the Capitol on January 6th, I think it would be really hard for the Biden administration to discount this problem. I mean, and that I hate to suggest anything good will come out of that. But I think that all these lawmakers having to crawl through tunnels to escape, you know, violent mobs will really bring home what the stakes are in this matter.
Thanks so much, Sheila.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Sheila Kolhatkar is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app, and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.